You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, Turkey demands its allies pick a side as it places the blame for yesterday's explosion in Ankara on Syria's YPG group. How will the international community respond? Meanwhile, could Israel be dipping into the Syrian conflict? A human rights observatory says they already have, but pro-Hezbollah sources deny the claim. We'll also assess the latest developments in Brussels as leaders from across the European Union continue discussions on Britain's membership of the bloc. Plus, is John Kerry really encouraging propaganda in Hollywood? And which is more American, a pastrami sandwich or a gun? We'll have all the answers ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Thursday's edition of Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Acting Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow at Chatham House and contributor for the Financial Times. Welcome both back to the programme. Good to have you with us. After yesterday's bombing in the Turkish capital that killed at least 28 people, the country's Prime Minister wasn't pulling any punches today. He called for Turkey's allies to cease cooperation with the group he deemed responsible. The group Ahmet Davutoğlu was referring to is the YPG, a Syrian organisation linked to the PKK. The PM appeared to issue an ultimatum to his allies, either stand with us or take the side of terrorists. Turkey's President Erdogan backed up the claim, saying those who support the group will be judged by history. Fairly harsh words, or clear, certainly, in intention. But this is a rather more complex issue than that, isn't it, Daniela?
It is, and the response isn't very surprising. After the bombing last October, which killed around 100 people, Turkish government immediately put the finger on Kurds, although it was later claimed by Islamic State. It's an obvious target. You know, I'm a little sceptical as well because of the rapidity at which they managed to say, well, we've worked out exactly where, how, what, you know, the perpetrator. This very much gels with wider foreign policy aims and the problem regarding Syria, that the international coalition see the Kurds as very much their allies, whereas Turkey is playing a very, very different game.
And Quentin, isn't that really the point? That we often talk in the context of Syria about all these different proxy interests and proxy conflicts. Surely, you know, no one would expect Turkey to be able to divorce, you know, its own internal established fissures, whether it's with the Kurds or with other interest groups there, from the bigger surrounding picture. They're not going to do that, presumably.
Well, it certainly doesn't appear so. I mean, the tragedy from the start is the Turks have not been targeting ISIS and the real hardline people at all because of their obsession with their own internal Kurdish problem. But, they had a ceasefire with their Kurds not so very long ago. And it's almost as if they've deliberately stoked up this conflict again. It is quite hard to see why this Syrian Kurdish group should have actually wanted to target Ankara and invite the wrath of the Turks. But the real nightmare of this situation is actually for the Europeans and the Americans, the West, if we still call them that, who only, you know, they really want to get rid of ISIS. And what's happening? The Turks are hammering the Kurds, who are probably the best anti-ISIS fighters they've got. And the Russians are hammering the moderate opposition to Assad. So it's lose-lose all round.
And I guess that's a difficult point, isn't it, Daniela, for the Turks? There's attacks like this, there's other pressures internally. But then, you know, Turkey receives a lot of diktats or, you know, requests for cooperation from the international community over from everything to how to handle the flow of refugees onward into Europe to as Quentin says, to address ISIS. I mean, you know, Turkey is in, to a degree, an invidious position here.
Well, you make a good point raising the internal pressures, because this is the kind of thing which the leadership can run to be reliably popular. Blame the Kurdish separatists for this, and that's a much easier way of sort of pulling public opinion opinion behind them. But I mean, it's an incredibly complex situation. And it's true that all the various actors rather cynically trying to exploit the chaos to achieve their own ends. Russia is doing it. The Assad government is doing it, and Turkey as well.
And I guess, Quentin, when it comes to sort of this Turkish nationalist narrative, if you like, some people will say, look, attacks like this, whether or not people go along with, you know, the figures of blame that Erdogan and others point, it will increase support for broader, wider Turkish military involvement in Syria against Syria. Do you think that what we've seen in the last couple of days could affect that dynamic? Does it necessarily shape that dynamic?
I think what we're heading for is a very, very nasty confrontation between Turkey and Russia. Mm. And with two leaders in Vladimir Putin on the Russian side and Erdogan on the Turkish side, who are both very powerful and irascible and nationalist figures, actually sort of almost, you know, gunning up for a fight. And there is a very nasty situation building up. NATO warships are now in the area, apparently going in to try and stop the refugee flow across to the Greek islands and so on. But there's a build-up of arms and weaponry in that area that could lead to a very, very nasty confrontation if we're not careful.
Now, we've already seen incendiary moments, Daniela, I guess, between Putin and Erdogan, or between Russia and Turkey, to use the sort of the country blocks. Do you think there's a real appetite for the kind of escalation that maybe sort of Quentin's alluding to there? Or we're actually mentioning quite explicitly, in fact. But does it suit either of those? We know that it plays to their a nationalist, a populist agenda. We know it plays well in the domestic media, but would they really want to ratchet up the tension yet further?
Well, cast your mind back to the incident a while ago when Turkey shot down the Russian fighter plane. We felt, I think, for a few hours at least, they're on the verge of the apocalypse, you know, because the implications were so dramatic. But then it became very clear that they were, they were winding back the rhetoric. It seemed a frankly bonkers move from Turkey's side. Another incident like that, something similar, I don't know how much more this kind of confrontation can take.
And actually, what's clearly happening on the ground is that the Russians, in their bombing, are clearing the way for the advance of this Kurdish group, thereby infuriating the Turks, and so deliberately stoking up the tension. And so my real fear is that people blunder into things like this, however much, you know, if you start ratcheting up the tensions, the possibility for actually blundering into a disaster is much greater.
I guess it always strikes me as interesting with Russia's involvement here that a lot of people talked about them, you know, starting a campaign of bombing, being much more aggressive, taking their support for the regime and making it concrete. But it seems that it's been a decent play in quite a number of ways. Is it working for Putin? Is this a good story for him still?
I think it's probably quite a good story at home and quite a good story for really making life more difficult, but for the Europeans, for example. More refugees.
Do you think that was his actual objective?
No, I think his objective was, one, he wanted to keep Assad in power because he wanted to show that he could do something for, if the Russians say we're backing you, we really mean it. But secondly, I suspect most important of all was keeping their military base on the Mediterranean, the only one they had. And then suddenly, a bonus. I mean, this is the great thing about Putin, the poker player, if you like. The bonus was, I can actually get all these refugees flooding across to Turkey and into Europe. That'll cause chaos there. But I do think that he may be miscalculated. He could end up as quite a Pyrrhic victory. He'll end up, I mean, if they take Aleppo, you know, it means Assad has got another little corner of the country. Vast swathes of Syria, they've done absolutely nothing about. They've got ISIS there. Assad is not going to be back in control. And meanwhile, sucking in all these other outside forces. Mm. And back home, Mr. Putin has an economy that's in a dire state because of the oil price collapse.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, Daniela. We know that the Russian economy is struggling, to put it mildly. Can he afford, I guess, financially or politically or diplomatically, to sustain the level of involvement that Quentin's describing there?
I got the impression, over recent years, I mean, since the Ukraine certainly, that Putin seems to be feeling his way through this. There isn't a really very long-term strategy, but there's a sense of opportunism and seeing how far the limitations can be pushed and what the West will put up with, which has been quite a lot. And that's been very successful so far. Now, Russia is invested in its links to a Syrian regime, but not Assad particularly. I don't see that there's particular loyalty. I mean, I think that there's definitely room for manoeuvre, some kind of stable transition, and its military and its strategic advantages in the Mediterranean. I think that's its primary concern right now.
Well, let's stay in and around Syria. Reports that Israel may have dipped into the conflict. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights suggested three Israeli rockets struck military outposts near Damascus. A pro-Assad Hezbollah-backed TV service insists there was no such attack, but an official announcement hasn't been made. Israel's in the past been accused of targeting the Syrian military and sites operated by Hezbollah. If these reports are true, it would be the second time Israel's launched attacks in Syria since the Russian involvement that we've been talking about. Daniel, to start with you, is this a conflict, again, talking about these proxy actors and these other players from without, is this a conflict Israel wants to involve itself with, or is it involved by dint of geography and everything else?
I know Israel absolutely doesn't want to involve itself in this conflict. I mean, it acts, privately admit, that it only acts when there are suggestions that that military material that would sort of change the parameters of the game, you know, serious hardware, might be on its way to Hezbollah. So these are very targeted strikes, and Israel has no interest in a wider involvement. I mean, the major impact of the Syrian civil war, one could argue, would be on Israeli domestic policy, because it's been proved quite useful for the right-wing government to say, look, there's absolute chaos elsewhere in the Middle East. If you don't have us, then you get ISIS, you get complete breakdown of state structures. As for actual involvement in Syria, the border with Syria has been traditionally really quite quiet, and I think Israel would like to keep it that way.
Mm. And Israel's always actually managed to get on with Assad perfectly well. It was a sort of standoff. But I wonder if Israel isn't getting concerned about the destabilisation of the two other countries on its borders because of Syria, i.e. Jordan and Lebanon, with these massive inflows of refugees. That must be quite worrying.
Certainly with Jordan, I mean, I've heard reports of, I mean, the Jerusalem is very keen to not to publicise this, but I've heard reports of all kinds of cooperation in terms of refugee management and sort of logistical issues. And this is, it's been something, I mean, this is certainly something that Israel has kept its eye on since the start of the, if we can still call it the Arab Spring, the idea that Lebanon and Jordan, particularly the destabilising effect of unrest on two countries which, you know, have a wobbly connection with stability.
Mm. Well, on that basis, I mean, there are also reports, of course, of, you know, where does Russian influence and Russian arms go? You know, do Russian arms make their way to Hezbollah, for example? Is this something that, you know, Israel can, they can deal with reports like that? It doesn't trouble them. I'm sure they're keeping more than a weather eye on where, you know, things are actually moving. But is the whole Israeli mindset presumably set up to deal with claim and counterclaim, and they pick their course and they're not too worried about what other actors say?
Relations with Russia have always been incredibly complex. Russia is theoretically an ally. I mean, there's more than a million Russians living in Israel. They're very strong trade links, diplomatic links, and so on and so forth. But Russia has long been a supplier of arms to Syria, for instance. It's not been, was never a particularly favoured member of the quartet, for instance, you know, talking to Hamas and hosting them and so on and so forth. But, you know, in that way, I think Israel negotiates its relationships with Russia in much the same way as the rest of the world. You know, there are interests and sometimes they coincide. But it's not always the warmest of relationships.
Well, that's a good cue to move us on to talk about what is happening in Brussels at the moment. UK's Prime Minister David Cameron was there today saying he's ready to battle for Britain as he seeks a deal for the UK to remain in the EU. His confidence will only take him so far. Perhaps leaked copies of the deal's final draft suggest there's still some way to go to convince other leaders to agree on treaty changes. France says no country should have an EU veto, etc., etc. Quentin, a lot of the commentary, the media coverage here in the UK apes this line, or certainly reports Cameron saying, you know, battling for Britain's rights and this sort of thing. What's the European view? Is it of, you know, the British PM arriving on some sort of crusade, or are people understanding? You know, a lot of other politicians across Europe starting to maybe think, actually, he's got a point in some, to a greater or lesser degree, when they look at their own relationship with the wider bloc. How would you sort of characterise the European view, if indeed there is one?
I think there's a fair amount of irritation, really, that the idea that what on earth is Cameron going on about when there are so much more serious problems that we've got to deal with, above all the refugee crisis, but dealing with the Russians, dealing with all the things we've just been talking about, what on earth are the British up to? Teasing away at little stitches in the whole edifice, because the problem that Cameron's got himself into is he's made a rather modest list of demands, which one suspects won't have any really substantial impact on the outcome of a referendum in Britain, but are actually all rather irritating to his partners in the European Union, like reducing welfare for East European workers coming to Britain, or wanting to have some sort of, not quite veto, but nearly a veto on decisions in the Eurozone, even though we don't want to be part of it, and so on. So all of these things are actually, there's pushback coming, and he may end up doing the absolute classic, you know, coming home with a bit of paper saying, peace in our time, and everybody will instantly say, well, it's not much of a peace, is it? And so he got himself into this position by blundering into having a referendum about Britain's relationship with Europe without thinking through what the content he wanted to have in the negotiations. And he's invented it as he went along. We were talking earlier about Putin being pretty short-term, is quite a chancer. So's David Cameron.
Do you go along with that, Daniel? Do you think he's really painted himself into this corner, Cameron? If so, why do you think? I mean, it seems he made some pretty basic errors if we follow Quentin's line of reasoning. So why, you know, surely he must have seen some of these problems coming.
No, I mean, I do agree, and I think a lot of this is down to internal party politics and pressure from within in his own party, and promising this referendum. But in actual fact, and I really hope it's as soon as possible, you know, there is a risk of it sucking all the energy out of domestic politics until it happens. And unsurprisingly, I am all pro, I mean, there are issues, and maybe reform is important, but I can't see the advantage of leaving the EU. I can't see the advantage of Brexit, and I don't think anyone has yet come up with a convincing argument. But if Cameron continues to blunder and comes back, you know, as Quentin says, with some strange and unconvincing results, that in itself could convince people that Europe is, will be better off out of Europe. I think it would be a disaster.
I mean, I think it's interesting that Cameron has slightly started to change his sales pitch now. And what he's really talking about is security, which is very clear that's what we need in this world at the moment, and that to be in Europe is very important for Britain's security. There's nothing about security actually on the agenda he's negotiating, but so it's the big picture. At the end of the day, though, I mean, I've been to 101 of these summits in my time. Sheer exhaustion is probably what's going to decide this thing. I mean, they're going to go through the night, and it's the person who can stay awake and stay focused longest who's going to get the deal.
Apparently they're going to have a kind of English breakfast meeting tomorrow morning. That's what I hear.
Sort of heart attack night, on a plate.
Well, exactly. An all-night session followed by bacon and eggs.
That sounds very agreeable. Just tell me, if we look a little further ahead then, what does happen? You've both actually alluded to the reasoning behind Cameron's short-termism on this, and the domestic and the internal party pressures on him. What happens then after this? Are we looking towards the, you know, deepening fissures within the Conservative Party? Can it even survive, depending on which way this goes, do you think, Quentin?
Well, I think if Cameron wins, he buys himself probably enough time to finish as Prime Minister before the party goes. But it will go back to war straight away, of course. I mean, he's going to come back, have a cabinet meeting if he's got a deal, and at least five of his ministers are going to say, right, well, we think it's a load of rubbish, and we're going to campaign against you. And, you know, these are not unimportant people. And if he loses a couple more, Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London, and Michael Gove, now the Justice Minister, that's seven serious ministers who've said, we don't even agree with what you've brought back. So the party is split. I mean, there's no way. Now, at the end of the day, if Cameron loses, I can't see how he stays as Prime Minister. I would have thought they'll have a thoroughly Eurosceptic Prime Minister. The last few brave pro-European Conservatives will disappear into the sunset and we'll have a very Eurosceptic government. I think it's still more likely that Cameron will win and buy peace for a little while.
Do you sort of agree with that analysis, Daniel? Or is there some sort of chink of light here? Could the Tories find some way to sort of reinvent themselves where this isn't the singular defining issue that impacts on everything?
Or is well, it just... I think the Tories have always been torn apart by Europe. I don't think that they'd have to reinvent themselves to the point where they would no longer be the Tory party. But no, I'm sort of dreamily looking off into the distance, imagining then a post-Cameron era with Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the opposition, which would be interesting for us journalists.
Or Jeremy against Boris, do you think?
It would be
entertaining,
it
if nothing
it's
else.
It's not implausible.
I fear I would have to leave the country.
you might not be alone. We'll take a short break now. I'll be back after this with Quentin Peel and Daniela Pellet. Stay tuned.
Magic and realism are constant themes in Miami. Our new Monocle Travel Guide to Miami explores this alchemy and shares the knowledge we've acquired from our regular pilgrimages down south.
There is a ridiculous amount of choice when it comes to hotels. The best options are on Miami Beach, often Art Deco gems with retro swimming pools and private beaches. This is Miami, so expect a few little flashy details that you might not get in other US cities. And take advantage of them. That's what you're here for, isn't it?
Nowhere in the US feels quite like Miami. Take a peek by watching our Miami Travel Guide film, now showing on Monocle.com.
Uh, 1821, this is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, still with me, Quentin Peel and Daniela Pellet. Now, anyone who's seen the film Trumbo with Bryan Cranston in the role that garnered him an Oscar nomination this year will know a thing or two about government-enforced propaganda. But when US Secretary of State John Kerry sat down with a group of Hollywood executives earlier this week, these similarities might have escaped him. Kerry posted a picture soon after the meeting saying that he enjoyed the conversation on how to introduce anti-ISIS messages into Hollywood blockbusters. Of course, Hollywood's no stranger to the concept, but doesn't this represent a form of modern propaganda of sorts? Daniel, what did you make of this? I don't know if this was the main substance of Kerry's discussion, but it certainly appeared to be that, judging from what he was tweeting about. Do you think that America is still a society that's quite engaged and quite relaxed about, well, I don't know, propaganda messages, in essence?
The whole thing seems extremely eccentric, because it's not like Hollywood is dedicated to putting, you know, sympathetic portrayals of ISIS or Islamist extremism, you know, quite the reverse. But I do wonder, I was thinking about this afternoon, and I do wonder whether actually the Americans take this whole idea of the effect of Hollywood films very seriously. I recall about 5 years ago, an Afghan friend of mine in Kabul got picked up by the Americans for spraying some sort of Banksy-style graffiti on the walls, criticising the American army. And he was taken in for questioning, and he was actually asked, which of the two films did he prefer, Avatar or The Hurt Locker? Avatar being supposedly anti-imperialist, anti-American, and the Hurt Locker being much more sympathetic to America, which makes me think perhaps this does speak to something more fundamental in, you know, sort of American political psyche.
I mean, it's interesting, Quentin, isn't it? It's hard to talk about Hollywood and propaganda and not mention, you know, we mentioned, you know, Dalton Trumbo, and you talk about the blacklist from the, and I think everyone knows that stories from the 40s into the 50s. Is there an unease, do you think? Or would there be an unease with people seeing Kerry having a sort of cosy powwow with a bunch of high-ranking Hollywood moguls? Or do you think people would just say, you know, par for the course?
It's just so clumsy. And I mean, that's what really gets one. But governments are, on the whole, really clumsy about this thing. At least sort of supposedly liberal governments that aren't supposed to do this sort of thing. I mean, of course, what we're seeing, and sorry to come back to Mr. Putin, but is some people who are brilliantly reinventing propaganda and in a really quite subtle way, and that's a danger. But hey, who needs to tell Hollywood to do its own propaganda? I mean, 90% of the films that come out of Hollywood seem to be chock full of propaganda. I've just been watching the Revenant recently. recently. What a dreadful film. And it's going to win all these Oscars. It's ghastly.
I'm sensing a breakout strand of Midori House at Quentin's, I don't know, Quentin's Film Hour or something. We'll come back to that. But he has a point, surely, Daniel, there, which is like, surely propaganda is only even theoretically effective if you don't tell people it's propaganda. And this is effectively what Kerry was doing with his description of this fireside chat about, oh, here's us talking about tackling Daesh. I mean, it's, as Gwen said, incredibly clumsy, if nothing else.
Yeah, and especially Hollywood films are not a major aspect of radicalisation. I mean, the whole thing was just clumsy, a mistake. And I really hope, actually, that this wasn't the subject of his discussions with all these Hollywood film producers. Because what a waste of a meeting.
What a waste of time. I mean, there is, I guess, a point, which is we've often talked about the propaganda from the other side here with, you know, IS or Daesh, whatever you call it, and how they play these propaganda games. Now, no one would make any equivalence between their productions, so-called, and what Hollywood does. But do you think there's a worry that people say, look, well, we need to strike back on a media platform as well, not just in a military capacity?
I think what Daesh is proving to us, but it's right across the internet, is the successful propaganda, if you like, of the internet is bottom up, not top down. And that's why this is so clumsy. You can't do it top down in any sort of subtle way. And so I think that's really, I mean, this is the challenge of the internet, that the internet is incredibly liberating and fantastically dangerous because the bad guys have as much access to bending all the information over the internet as the good guys do.
I think one of the more convincing, like, counter-propaganda things I've seen was an internet meme showing a whole load of ISIS videos showing the militants, you know, being dubbed to, I can't remember what it was, Justin Bieber or something, super humiliating. And that was actually quite funny. And that, I think, works a lot better than, than sort of high-handed government
ideas. A bit of wit never,
yeah, exactly,
never goes amiss. Well, on which subject, let's talk a bit more about American symbolism. What symbolises America best, a handgun or a sandwich? It seems a slightly absurd question in the light of some of these heavy hitting issues we've been discussing. But according to one presidential candidate, the answer is definitely a handgun. Jeb Bush attracted high fives from the NRA, one imagines, this week when he posted an image of a handgun on social media, captioned simply, America. It's not exactly clear, again, talking about, you know, the medium is the message, what exactly he was saying, but presumably America is guns, guns are America. Other people have been less convinced. New York's mayor decided to take it a step further. Bill de Blasio posted his own version of what makes America, accompanied by the same caption, his picture was a pastrami sandwich. Daniela, which camp are you in? Sandwich or
Daniela has a real problem.
I've got a problem here because I'm a vegetarian, but also against guns. But I think the pastrami sandwich was, you know, you could interpret it on a lot of levels. It was hugely overstuffed. You know, that could be a comment on consumerism.
I have it on good authority. It's $20, the specific sandwich, which that's quite expensive.
Right. So perhaps he was making, you know, a deeper comment. I mean, what I would like to see, this is being taken up by a range of countries. I would like to see, I was thinking about this on the way over here, and perhaps the British one would be a picture of somebody lying drunk in a gutter. I don't know.
That's very negative, Daniela. Maybe not inaccurate, but Quentin, I guess one point some people might make in sort of semi-seriousness here is, what's Jeb Bush playing? Is this the sort of playbook on how not to proceed with the presidential campaign?
Well, I fear, given the gun culture there is in America, it may be the right playbook to play. And that's what's truly scary. I was thinking about these two things as I was coming up the road here today, and I was thinking, the trouble is, both these images are images of America. And what's a better image? And hey, you know, a baseball player or something like this. But no, these are two rather shocking images. That's to say, the gun, which is truly shocking, and the overstuffed pastrami sandwich, which is also, I mean, I love pastrami, but not that much.
Pastrami within limits. Just very, very briefly, Daniela, I know we wanted to shoehorn the Supreme Pontiff in here. Apparently the Pope today has said that Donald Trump, we can't really talk about the GOP race without mentioning him, is not a proper Christian because Christians don't believe in building walls. In a word or two, can even the Supreme Pontiff derail the Trump campaign, do you think? Do you hope?
In a word, no. Oh. I don't think people that subscribe to the sort of soft and cuddly version of Catholicism that the Pope is trying to brand himself as promoting are really going to be open to that. If you like Trump, you like Trump.
Oh dear, that's a bit of a negative note to end on.
I think
on.
You should have said, get thee to a monastery.
Lovely stuff. That's Quentin Peel and Daniela Peled, my guests here on Midori House, and that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our production team, Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our researcher Charlie Monahan, and our studio manager Chris Chilvers. More music up next. Marco Sippi will be bringing you that, and we'll have the Monocle Daily 2200 London time a little later this evening here in London. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. Do join us then. Goodbye.